So Nicola explained to you about the protocol. Something totally outrageous. Very nice. No one was for. Series, Writers Researching Fact and Fiction. I'm Janet Small from the Summer School Office. I'm happy to start today with Angela Michalwa here, and she's talking about the fascinating genre of crime fiction. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She has a first novel called Red Ink, was published in 2009. It was a crime thriller set in modern-day Johannesburg. It's loosely based on her encounters with a convicted serial killer, which sounds quite chilling, and I'm sure she'll be talking more about that. This book was long listed for the Sunday Times Literary Awards and received both critical and popular acclaim. She then also published a second novel called 30th Candle, which focuses on the escapades and sexual misadventures of modern women as they search for happiness and hope for love in modern day Johannesburg. I think I won't ask Angela how autobiographical that one was. This book was shortlisted for the Booksellers Award because of its popularity. And her latest book, Black Widow Society, is derived from the natural phenomenon where a female Latrodectus spider bites off its partner's head after the mating ritual.
That's not by
no, definitely we won't claim for it. The book is a crime thriller as well, delving into the workings of a secret society of wealthy women who conspire to kill their emotionally and physically abusive husbands with the aid of a meticulous and highly skilled hitman. I hope you husbands are quaking. Angela lives and works in Johannesburg, and she's happily married with two children, and I'm sure her husband behaves beautifully.
Of course.
Before I hand over to Angela, let me just say to you that her books are on sale upstairs on level 3 near the canteen, and she would be able to sign any books that you might purchase. So I'd like to hand over to her to talk about getting out of the skin of a murderer.
Thank you for that introduction. I have to start by making a confession. The title for this lecture or this talk, because it's a talk, was meant to be a deterrent. I'm a shy person. I hate public speaking. So I thought if I came up with a topic like this, you know, two people will show up and we'll just have a chat. And, you know, so I'm very worried. I don't know how come people are so fascinated by the topic of having friends in confined spaces. Because, let me just see what's going on. He's got a fancy little gizmo that I usually use. And then he's put it, okay, here we go. Okay, here we go, sorry. We're in business now. Okay, so I was fascinated by, you know, the interest in this course, because usually we want to have friends in high places, important people who help steer us in, you know, socially or in our careers. These are people like people like Rudolph Giuliano, people like Rudy Giuliano, who is the former mayor of New York. You know him for steering the people of New York City and the American nation through the tragedy of 9/11. So these are the kinds of people that, you know, we all want to be associated with. We want to go to breakfast with them. We want to have them on speed dial. The Dalai Lama, of course, everybody reveres him. He's been honored. He's been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his nonviolent struggle for the liberation of Tibet in 1989. He's got multiple awards. People flock to share a bit of his wisdom. And then we have our friends in confined spaces. This is Jeffrey Dahmer. He is one of the most notorious serial killers of the 21st century. He was a serial sex offender. He sodomized and killed more than 17 men between the period of 1978 to 1991. He would dismember and rape his victims, and then he would consume their body parts or keep them as trophies in his fridge. He was sentenced to 15 consecutive life terms, and then he was subsequently murdered by a fellow inmate in 1994. This lady is Eileen Wuornos. She was portrayed by our own Charlize Theron in the movie Monster. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. She was also a serial killer who killed 7 men. She used to work as a prostitute, and for some reason in 1989 she decided to start killing her victims, and she would claim that they had either raped or attempted to rape her while she was working as a prostitute. She was eventually convicted and sentenced to death for 6 of the murders. And was executed by the state of Florida by lethal injection in 2002. My personal favorite, Moses Tutole. This was one of the first well-known cases. He was one of the most well-known cases of, he was one of the most prominent serial killers post-democracy. He ran an organization called Youth Against Human Abuse, which is quite ironic, given that he had started to lure young women who were looking for jobs in Johannesburg in the East Rand. He would offer them employment, he would promise them employment, but then proceed to take them to secluded areas and rape them. He would then strangle them with their underwear. He had claimed, by 1994, he claimed over 30 victims. He started enjoying the coverage of his crimes, because, you know, the Star, everybody, I think you all remember that period where it was the Cleveland Strangler all over the papers. And he started forming relationships with journalists. One in particular is Thames and Dibier. He'd call her and pretend to be somebody else. So he would just, he gave himself an alias, and then he would say that he's the Cleveland Strangler. He would give her directions to some of the spots where he killed his victims. And he just enjoyed, you know, taunting the media and the police. In 1995, he was eventually caught, and the police managed to track him down to his hideout in Johannesburg. Upon being discovered, he attacked the police with a hatchet, wounding one of them. As a result, he was shot and wounded, and eventually arrested and was taken to hospital, where he was treated for his wounds and was diagnosed with HIV. These are some of his victims, you know, young, beautiful women who, you know, they were mothers, they had, you know, their kids to take care of, their families to take care of. They really thought that this person was going to give them, you know, a leg up in life, give them some employment, but obviously, it was a fatal mistake that they made, and this man ended up raping them and killing them. So how do I fit into all of this? There was a call that came through to my office phone in 2003. I'd just started my business. I used to be a journalist, and like all other journalists during that time, especially crime reporters, I was following the case of Moses Sithole. I wrote to him requesting an exclusive interview after he was sentenced, and he didn't call. And that was in 1997, I think, when he was finally convicted. But he called me how many years later? About 7 years later, 2003, decided to just pick up the phone. And he says to me, and he even calls me by my Xhosa name, you know, which is so familiar. I just thought, who is this person? He says, hello, Bulelo, this is Moses. Like, Moses who? He says, Moses Sithole. I thought, couldn't remember anything about writing the letter, of course, by this time. I had moved on. I'd left journalism. So my world was far removed from, you know, just this man and these kind of crimes. And he says to me, well, you wrote to me saying that you want to write a book about me, and I decided to contact you because I was so touched by your words. So he says to me, I'm just checking if you're still interested. And I just thought, I don't know what this person is talking about. I think I was actually running to a meeting. So I said to him, look, I'm running. Can I call you? I'm just running to a meeting right now. I'm not sure what you're talking about, but can I call you back? And he says, well, I'm at the Pretoria Maximum Security Prison, so you can't call me. But if you want, I can call you back. So then we made an arrangement for him to call me back, which he did. And we spoke at length, and I had, you know, started to kind of jog my memory, and I remembered having written this letter to him when I was practicing as a journalist. And I kind of made a call because my business was quite young and it was quiet, and I'd always wanted to write a novel, like most journalists, most writers. So I just thought, well, maybe this could be an opportunity, and certainly this is a story that people would want to hear. I mean, I'm curious, you know, personally about this man and his motivations behind doing what he did. You know, I'd like to find out more. So I agreed to meet with him, and I went to Pretoria Maximum Security. I remember I was quite calculating about how I was going to present myself to him because, you know, of course, this is somebody who rapes women, you know, who's raped, you know, scores of women. So I just wanted to be as unattractive as possible, and so I wore my oldest jeans and like an old raggedy jersey and just walked in there. And I was quite naive because I had the presumption that when I get there, there'll be a prison cell, you know, prison bars separating us. But I was in for a huge surprise because I was guided to these open grounds, and, you know, it's just an open area like this, and there's little concrete tables and, you know, round chairs, and you sit there and you wait for your prisoner to come and you sit down with them and you just, you know, just directly just facing them. So I was so nervous. And he came and he shook my hand and hugged me. Too much information. No, I'm joking. So he introduced himself, and he said how happy he was that I had taken on, you know, this project. Yeah, I called it a project, and he said, you know, he thinks it's time now to tell his story, and he's been waiting for the right person to tell it to. And my letter, that infamous letter, convinced him that I was the right candidate. I think now, in hindsight, now that I know him, I actually realized that what it was about was that, you know, there had been so much media interest in his story over those years, and scores of journalists had come to see him, you know, BBC reporters, local reporters, everybody. And of course, I mean, after a couple of years, it gets a bit old and they move on to the next one. So I think he was bored, and just, you know, when he went through the mail and he just picked up this letter and thought, okay, let me call this fool and see if she's still interested. Anyway, that's my theory. So we met, and so I decided to take it on. So we agreed on doing this together, that I would write his biography. So I started making my surgeon to Pretoria Maximum Security once every 2 weeks or so. it was very difficult. It was, you know, an almost impossible task in that you're not allowed to bring, you know, recording devices for one. You're not allowed to bring notepads or pens or anything like that. So he came up with this idea, once again, he was allowed a little notepad about this size and a pencil. So he would bring these to our meetings, and then as I sat across him, he'd just slide it across, and then I'd make some notes and just jot down, you know, key points that would trigger some of the stuff that we discussed. And so that's how that's the arrangement we had. And I remember, you know, he was always so manipulative. I remember one time I'd gone to see him, and we were doing this whole thing with a little piece of paper. He saw this warden and he said to me, "Oh no, you know, today it's this guy. He's so vigilant. You know, we have to be careful about how you take down your notes and everything." So I said, "Okay, fine." And then I jotted my stuff, and then when I was about to leave, he asked me to hand over the notepad, and I did that. And then he takes it and kind of crumples the pieces of paper, and I'm thinking, what the heck is this guy doing? And then as I stood up to go, he comes and he hugs me, and then he shoves the pieces of paper down my back pocket. And it just caught me, it was such a seized moment, it just caught me by surprise, and it was so intimate, and it just completely caught me off guard. And I felt, I know it sounds over dramatic to say I felt violated, but knowing what he's done and how he relates to women, it just kind of really brought home the fact that this is, you know, this is who this person is, because familiarity obviously makes you relax. I mean, the more I went to see him, the more he became my buddy. I mean, we would talk, we'd shoot the breeze, talk about like the weather and the soccer or whatever, politics, because he's got access to all this media. He has access to television and newspapers and stuff like that. We talk about politics and whatever. So you kind of forget who you're dealing with. So it would take little things like that to kind of bring the reality back home. So it went on for a while. I mean, it was 6 to 8 months, and I was really getting into this project, and I would go back home and I would write up, you know, my notes and everything. But then I realized something was happening. This person had actually, you know, the upper hand in this relationship, because, you know, he decided, I was supposed to be the writer of the story, the master behind this whole thing. I mean, that's what I thought. I was supposed to set the tone for how the story was going to be told and how I'm going to angle it and everything. But I realized that the more I went to see him, the more he was using this to reach his own ends. For one thing, you know, in the beginning he would talk about the women and why he was incarcerated. But the more I went to see him, the more he wanted to talk about his childhood and the abuse that went down there, and how, you know, all these things have had such a horrible impact on him as a young man trying to make it. And I was getting irritated with the pace of the whole thing, and I decided to tell him that, look, you know, I think we've covered your childhood. I think it's pretty clear where you're coming from. So let's start to talk about the murders and the rapes and everything, and how you came to be here. And the breaking point for me, like the moment of like, oh, this is it, I can't handle this anymore, is when he said to me, you know, Bulelo, you know what I've decided? You know what I think is going to happen? I'm going to walk. He says, I'm going to walk. And I said, what do you mean you're going to walk? He says, I've been talking to my lawyers, and with this project that we're doing, I know that we're building up a case, and I know that, and I just thought, like, this is not the reason why I'm here. And I felt like I'd been had, you know. And I said, but that's not the whole point of this exercise for me. That's not what I'm here. What I'm here for. And he said, no, but I've sent you. You know, he sent me his whole case files. He'd mailed them to my house, to my mom's postal address, not physical address. And he said, I thought that was the whole point. I said, no, that's not what I'm in here for. And so that was kind of a turning point in our relationship. For me, I just decided, well, if that's how it's going to go, I'm not going to continue with this project. But And so I left it. And just to show how manipulative he is, he realized that I'd kind of really distanced myself from everything. And obviously he was very annoyed about it. And then he started calling my office phone. He started calling my cell phone at all hours. I don't know where he got access. And then I landed a project in my business that I was running. I landed a project that was fairly high profile. It was getting coverage in the media. When it was close to fruition, I got a call from one of the sponsors of this project. And he says to me, we need to talk. And I thought, what could it be about? And then we sat down and he says to me, I've been getting these very strange calls about you. There's a person who says he's a journalist. This project was based in the Eastern Cape. He says he's a journalist for the Daily Dispatch, and he says that we mustn't trust you, that you've got this history. Mm-hmm. I thought, what the hell? I'm just starting my business. I don't know anything. I haven't done anything. And it was so crazy. And I thought, no, I don't understand this. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no clue who this person could be. So then I thought about it, and I went through, the people that I've met and had done work with. I just couldn't think of anyone except, Moses, but I thought it was too far-fetched. I mean, how could he have had access? How would he even know about this? And I remembered it in the papers, and, that's what he does. I called somebody else who was a service provider, one of my service providers in the Eastern Cape, and then I asked him, tell me something, have you had any funny calls, since we started doing this project? He says, actually I have, I felt uncomfortable telling you. And then I asked him what it is, same story, journalist telling stories. I thought, this guy, I spoke to him, he called all the time. I asked him, have you been calling people? He says, what about? And I told him, he says, no, I don't know what you're talking about. We're friends, Anyway, so that was the end of that. But I mean, he still calls, even to this day, 2014, he still calls. He calls me on my birthday every year. He's one of the first people to wish me happy birthday every year. It's crazy. Anyway, so why did I do it? I mean, why befriend a serial killer? I think for me, it was just about, I think this is a common thing. I'm not sure if I'm crazy, tell me now. I think we all just have this curiosity, the need to understand, why psychopaths do what they do, especially violent crimes, why people commit violent crime. We need to have answers to that. We want to unravel the psychology behind it because it's so frustrating, it's scary. And unnerving, knowing that there's people like this just running around. I mean, it could be your neighbor, it could be just somebody who assaults you one day as you're going on about your life. So I think we have that curiosity, that need. And of course, we just want to preserve our society. And for me also, just to preserve your own progeny, you want to know what it is that makes a person like that. I mean, what must I do as a parent to avoid that? So I think those are some of the reasons why those of us, crime writers, journalists, put ourselves in these kind of situations. I looked at some of the research that's been done about the criminal mind, especially, psychopaths who commit violent crime. Alfred Grixis sees the rise of depictions of real-life monsters as indicative of the uncertainty in which we currently live and its resulting fears. He says, feelings of fear derive from the conviction of loss of control and the sense of helplessness, which become dominant in situations when the cognitive system can neither assimilate the environment into its own structure, nor adapt itself to the structure of the environment. So when environmental controls are weak, when we have rampant crime and we don't see people being brought to book, criminals being brought to book, when we see acts of violent crimes, people who maim and kill and disembody people, we don't understand it. We can't, our minds can't assimilate it, we can't make sense of it. And so we seek magical solutions for controlling the monsters, around us, the monsters around us. As each era has its own fears, certain crime-related genres tend to dominate during these periods. For instance, gangsters' films started to emerge in the 1930s, film noir in the 1940s, science fiction in the 1950s, horror films in the 1970s, and serial killer films in the 1990s, which I think is quite interesting if you look at South Africa, that there's so much crime fiction now that's cropping up, and a lot of it does have to do with, you know, violent crime. Because I think we're trying to make sense of it, and of course the space of, you know, a book or a film is more comforting than the newspapers, because there you are hoping for some kind of resolution. You're hoping that in the end, you know, good will overcome evil and that criminals will be brought to book. And so I think that's why there is this fascination and interest from us, certainly as writers, that we're just trying to make sense of this world. And it's something that is really difficult to distill and understand. So that's the best that basically you can do, is just to try and make sense of it. I mean, some of the interviews with these psychopaths, they say things like Ted Bundy. I think you all are familiar with him. He says, "I didn't know what made people want to be friends. I didn't know what made people attractive to one another." He also went on to say, when he'd been convicted, he says, I'm as cold a motherfucker as you ever put your eyes on. I don't give a shit about those people." Moses Sithole said through his whole trial, some of the women that managed to escape from him, that he had managed to rape but couldn't, you know, when he tried to kill him, they managed to escape. He just sat through the trial and he would laugh. I mean, he would smile during their testimonies. And some of the things that he, some of the things he's been recorded as saying, he says, "I've never trusted women. It all started with my mother. She was a bitch. I've always thought that women are bitches." So, very charming, of course. So I've looked at some of the research that's been done into understanding the mind of a serial killer. Bent Brogaard, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Missouri, she published a paper entitled "The Superhuman Mind." In it, she posits, which I think this is a common thing that's been, you know, it's the big question basically: is psychopathy a product of Mother Nature, or is it a result of upbringing? It's nature versus nurture. Minnesota study of twins read apart. It revealed that psychopathy is actually 60% inheritable. Psychopathic traits are due to more than are due more to DNA than to upbringing. They actually found that this has to do with our brains, the way that our brains are made up. This part, let me see if this clever little gadget will help me. This part is called the amygdala, and it's about its connection. There's a high connection between it and the prefrontal cortex. So they found that in serial killers, there's a decreased connectivity between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. And these amygdalae are almond-shaped groups of nuclei that are located within the temporal lobes of the brain. And what they do, what they control is, they control it's a part of the brain that drives our E-type behaviors, such as rage, violence, eating, sex, and drinking. So if you've got damage in that area, they made an experiment with monkeys and found that there's an overreaction to all objects. There's hypoemotionality, so they don't display the kind of emotions you'd expect. And then there's a loss of fear, and there's a hypersexuality, which I think is prevalent with almost all the high-profile cases of serial killers. There's some kind of there's usually rape involved, there's sodomy involved. It's a common feature across all, you know, psychopaths that we know of. And the other thing that so there's another professor who has studied further the brains of psychopaths. His name is James Fallon. He's from the University of California. He's a neuroscientist at the University of California. So he found, when he was tracing his own lineage, he was startled to learn that there were more than 7 killers in his own family. So he then set out to test, his nuclear family to see what he would find. And what was interesting was that when he submitted his family members to PET brain scans, his wife's scan was normal, mother, normal, siblings, normal, kids, fine. But there was one surprise. His PET scan looked exactly like one of the killers. So he then submitted them to further tests. He was testing for the MAOA gene, which is, it's called the warrior gene. So it's associated with aggression. Once again, he found that all the tests had low aggression variant except for his. So the question is, if he presents with all these signs of psychopathy, how come he hasn't killed anyone yet? So then the main thing that you would be looking for then in that case is the third ingredient, which again, history proves it, because in people like Moses Sithole, it's about abuse as well, or violence in one's childhood. So that's the one ingredient, for instance, that was lacking in him, which is why maybe hopefully we don't have him as another statistic when we study these serial killers. So the research that I did with Moses, it helped me a lot in writing my first novel, which is Red Ink, because what happened there was, as you know, that I started out writing a biography, and I sat with this manuscript, this incomplete, extremely incomplete manuscript, and then I met a publisher and told him my whole story about my whole story with Moses, and he said, well, why don't you fictionalize it? I thought, why not? That's actually a very good idea. So then I set out to tell that story from a much safer, again, going back to that feeling of fiction and how it helps create that distance between this very harsh and unpalatable reality, and trying to just kind of make sense of it through fiction. So I really enjoyed the process because I could take that relationship and my interactions with this guy, which was very disturbing. I mean, there's days when I couldn't sleep because I worried if that was the right choice to have made in the first place, just to bring him into my life. Because I remember when Pretoria Maximum Security shut down, he called me and said to me, he wants, they're going to be transferring them, and he wants a transfer to Lyoko prison, which is just like down the road from me. And I'd never told him where I lived, but I mean, now we know by now the kind of person he is. He's able to do his own research. So that was quite chilling and disturbing, but through writing this book, it was a bit of a cathartic process because I was able to kind of imagine the worst kind of case scenario of what could have happened with this guy. But at least I could, kind of absorb it from a distance and know that he's safely in jail, hope forever. He's got multiple sentences. Hopefully he'll never escape. Hopefully. How it helped me now as a fiction writer is that I believe that crime fiction has to be strongly both character and plot driven. I think we get into if you think about all the crime books that you've probably enjoyed, you've developed a very good sense of the characters. And if it's the protagonist and maybe they're fighting this thing, this evil thing that's always looming, you develop quite a connection with them because of the kind of makeup of the person, the multi-dimensional aspects of that person. Obviously, when you're going to create the character of a serial killer, this is not somebody that you can draw from your neighbor or your uncle and, the familiar. You have to kind of go outside of yourself and go face to face and meet with evil to try and draw that convincing picture of what evil looks like. So I suppose in that way, it helped. And I think that it's just an important aspect of research when you're building up your characters and also obviously plot, is to kind of get out of your comfort zone, if needs be, and get to know the face of evil so that when you draw the picture, it's convincing and it's believable. and it's as disturbing as possible. Joking. So psychopaths don't react the same way to situations as human beings. I mean, most human beings, they simply don't. So I found it very useful, having had that interaction with Moses, to understand that, you know, at the very base level of it, it's about their motivations just differ from that of ordinary people. They just don't see the difference between right and wrong. And that differentiates them from the rest of society. So that's how I think that experience kind of helped me in writing not only Red Ink, which focused on a mass murderer, a multiple murderer, but it also helped me in a way to work on other crime novels. My latest book is called The Black Widow Society. You've heard a little bit about what the premise of the book entails. And it's quite interesting, when I was putting together this presentation, I've never thought about these women, because their motivation is so different from that of a psychopath, a cold-blooded killer. You heard that the society is about women who feel that they are in relationships where they are emotionally or physically abused. So they seek refuge in the secret society that is very well organized, a well-oiled machine. You've got Tallulah at the helm, and she's got her two cohorts there. They call themselves the Triumvirate. So they're very powerful. And it all started with Tallulah's own story. She was in an abusive relationship. She was a very well-respected and well-revered member of her society. And her husband as well, they were seen as a power couple. And, you know, behind the scenes, he was beating her to a pulp. He was bringing women and sleeping with them at their house. It's just, you know, horrible. And she eventually snapped, as the series says, the crime series says. She snapped, and she roped in her friend, who was a lawyer at the time, Nkosazana, who then roped in one of her clients, an ex-con named Mzwake, to help with the hit. And they did it so successfully and impeccably that, you know, later down the line, when she met Edna Whitehead, who she met through business, who had a similar problem, they were able to then dispense the same method to get rid of her errant husband. And so then this secret society kind of thrived. And, you know, once the husband was eliminated, they would collect the insurance, and then, you know, they were then able to be more organized. And I know I sound like I'm enjoying it, but I don't have that Amadela stuff in my brain. But so then I thought, when I was doing this presentation, I just thought, so are these people, are they psychopaths? I mean, okay, Daisy DeMelka, you know about her. She was the first South African, a second South African woman to be hanged. I think it was in the 50s. Sorry, let me check my notes. I forgot about that. But anyway, she killed two of her husbands. She poisoned them. She was a nurse. And she also, for some reason, undiscernible reason also, she decided to also kill her son with arsenic. And then she was hanged for the crime of killing her son. And then you have Thandi Maqubela. She's a much more recent case. She's been called the Black Widow all over the papers. She was also a nurse by some coincidence. So those of you who are married to nurses, I think just careful out there. She's currently a businesswoman, and she was found guilty of murdering her husband, Judge Maqubela, whom she accused of being a philanderer, and you know, he bankrupted them, and so on and so forth. So then the question, I think, is just out there. I mean, does it mean anyone who's capable of murder? Is that a psychopath? Or if it's about people like these who feel that there's a higher purpose. I mean, these women really think that they are helping women. They feel that they are the members of the society. If it were not for the society, they would be in dire straits. They would be abused. They might even die. Some of them have been infected with HIV because the husbands are philanderers, and so on and so forth. So I think that question, I just thought it was just an interesting one to throw out there. because as I was preparing this, I'd never thought of these women the same way that I thought of the serial killer, for some reason, and I didn't feel the need to even go out there. I had read a story that actually inspired the idea behind this book. I'd read an email that was circulating. It was written by a woman who was married to a doctor, and you know, she just recounted some of the incidents where this man would just kick her around and do all sorts of horrible things, and she also snapped. And now this is a true story. She was writing while in prison, and she snapped and killed this guy, and was ready and happy to serve the sentence, because she felt, she said she was at peace with what she had done. So she was the inspiration, basically. She planted the seeds for this particular book. So I just think for the question for us is, I don't think that every human being is capable of murdering another person. I mean, that's a huge thing. So I think the question that I'd just like to leave you with, just as a question of interest, is everybody who's capable of killing somebody, can they be classified as a psychopath? I don't know. But that's how I'd like to close this session. Thank you very much. Questions?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I just finished the book and I
didn't
like to put it down.
Which one? Black Widow Society? Where's your husband?
Long
gone. Okay, I won't ask. No, I won't ask any further questions. Yes, ma'am?
I haven't finished. Sorry, I haven't
asked. Sorry. Yes.
He's not a serial killer, but he's the hitman.
Mm-hmm.
And I found him a very likable character.
You know, the funny thing about Mzwakhe, that's the interesting thing, because I also found him quite likable. I kind of had a crush on him, because when I was building up his character, and then, I mean, he listens to country music, and, you know, he's quite romantic. It just, you know, it's an occupational hazard that he has to go out and kill his men. But otherwise, he is quite charming, I would say that.
Did you do research for his character?
No, I actually just, well, I did research in terms of the hits, because, you know, if this society has been existing for 20 years undetected, obviously their modus operandi has to be slick and untraceable. So that is where the research came in. But I was able to, I don't know, maybe borrow from, not Moses, I think I borrowed his characteristics from different people that I've met. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Did you do any research on the availability of hitmen? There seems to be a
proliferation of them.
Cape Town costs you about 10,000 there.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's actually a point that one of the characters made, that you know, the secret society, you pay quite a high price to get them to eliminate your husband. But one of the characters, in her naivete, she says, oh, no, I've heard that, you know, you can get somebody for 5,000 rand. I think it's just about the desperation and the abject poverty that exists in this country, that people are willing to kill people for nothing, that human life is now worthless, basically. I think it's just a product of our society. Yes.
After your experience with Moses, if he ever got out, do you think he would want to harm you?
I think so, because remember that we ended on a note where I wasn't going to continue writing the book. We'd agreed, and he got his lawyers he had lawyers in Rosebank, fancy lawyers. I don't know how that relationship, but anyway. So he got his lawyer. He asked me to meet a lady to write to sign a contract that said that I wouldn't write his story, his biography. And I did sign it, and I didn't write his biography, but he knows about this book. So, but like I said, he calls and, you know, he shoots the breeze and everything. And once he asked me, you know, shortly after it came out, he says, oh, I see you wrote the book. And I said, what book? He says, I see you wrote a book, Red Ink. I said, yes, I did. And then he says, I'd like to read it one day. I said, yeah, I'm sure you would. And he says, yeah, I'm going to try and get somebody to get it for me. I said, okay, all right. And then I was like, oh my God. And then he called me sometime later and he says, you know, I can't get hold of that book. I said, why? He says, I tried. I spoke to one of the warders. They said, no, because you've been coming to see me. They can't allow me to have that book. So, yeah. But I'm sure, I mean, he's a clever guy, so I'm sure he's put two together.
But won't they actually consult if they want to give him parole
instead? No, he's got multiple. He's serving about 5 life sentences. Exactly. Yeah, so it's pretty much.
Unless if he joins the Black Widows, sorry.
That will help him out. Yes, ma'am. Yes, he was. Do you remember Minky Pistorius? Yeah. She's a serial profiler. Yes, she's one of the people that did the
diagnosis. Is that a common trait? I mean, you mentioned quite a lot, but I mean, from what I understand, from what you said, it's a common trait among serial killers. But is that a fact?
Well, the ones that I cite here. Are psychopaths. They've been diagnosed as psychopaths, and there's a difference between a psychotic serial killer who hears voices and things that somebody's, you know, that they see, they look at you and say, you know, I don't like, there's some evil in your eyes, and then they attack you. That's a psychotic killer. But a psychopath is much more manipulative. There's a bit more calculation going on there, and there's a bit of an awareness of what they're doing.
About the violence, you mentioned that is an ingredient for creating a psychopath. And do you know?
You mean the childhood violence, or you mean violence in their upbringing?
Yes. In their history. Do you know if it has to be violence that they directly experience, like maybe being beaten by a parent or something? Or just maybe their brother or sister being beaten and they're in the environment and it affects them?
I don't know what the correlation is, but I know that the people that I read about, except for Jeffrey Dahmer, because he seems to come actually from a fairly normal family, but he just started displaying violent traits. He would kill animals and, you know, but for the rest of them, it is like they all claim that there was violence, especially sexual violence in their upbringing, that they were sexually violated. Yes, sir.
I gather there's a study going on at the moment, researching veterans of the United States Army who've had, should we say, professional killing experience. That violent crime is quite a common occurrence after they get out of the military. Mm-hmm. And pretty obviously they have learned how to kill people pretty effectively. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying what, that it's learned violence as opposed to just being endemic in them?
Special forces soldier can break somebody's neck in a matter of seconds.
Yeah, but I think that's a different profile then, because they've been trained to be killers, as opposed to somebody where it's inherent in them to kill.
I just found that children today, like teenagers, the way they view violence in the country, I'm a teacher, and you know, often discussed terrible things in the newspaper, and you know, there's a pervasive sort of attitude that, they're so desensitized, and a lot of kids who play these really, really violent games. I mean, there is a study that says that it doesn't affect their minds and that it's totally harmless.
You mean the video games?
Yeah, yeah. Your terrorist is dead, the terrorist.
And they get more and more violent every year.
I mean, I can attest to the fact that it does, because when you're discussing it, there's absolutely no reaction to, for example, when you're reading a story about somebody who's died, they say, oh, dead meat. You know, and there's so little kind of understanding of, you know, the emotional value of loss and grief and so on.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm saying there's this concern as a parent that, you know, what does this all mean? Because if you look at the United States, these school killings, most of those kids are just middle class kids. I mean, they don't live in violent homes. They're not, you know, they don't have a bad upbringing, but they're so desensitized to it that they just think it's cool that maybe if you kill somebody, there's like this red stuff that oozes out, but is it really blood or is this person really dead? It's as if they don't have that human connection to the implications of killing somebody.
But we used to have comics.
But they were not as gratuitous. The violence was not as gratuitous, and it wasn't as in your face as what we're exposed to now. It wasn't as, was it? No, it wasn't. And it was on paper, as opposed to when you see it being so. Okay, I'm going to take three last questions. Yes, I see you. Yes, they are.
So, in a sense, they're obviously ladies that you're wanting us to connect with as a leader, but how do you make that transformation between having that connection as being they're fighting a viable cause and they're justified in what they're feeling and actually becoming murderers? Like, how do you position them?
I believe that evil cannot be countered by evil in the end. So as much as, and the book is, it's quite satirical. There's quite a lot of, you know, funny bits. There's a lot of tongue-in-cheek stuff going on there. So that's just also another element that we just have to be aware of so that I don't sound like I'm just, you know, being completely insensitive. But basically, the main premise, yes, at the beginning, you're supposed to sympathize with these women. It's about just drawing attention to the prevalence of domestic violence, and I think usually domestic violence is seen as something that's common in the lower echelons of society, and the reason why I purposefully positioned this book and this society as a club for the elite is that, you know, there are instances of domestic violence in wealthier communities. And those women feel as entrapped as their poorer counterparts. They feel as helpless, and so this is where this society comes in. But in the end, you can't you can't fight violence with violence. So in the end, without giving away too much, they get their just desserts as well. Not in the same way, but yeah. So it's also a cautionary tale that, you know, we shouldn't all just decide to go off and kill our husbands if they're cheating or abusive. There's other ways to sort out such problems. Yes, sir.
Just a bizarre thought. It's fine, and they have to do it.
Oh, sorry.
A bizarre thought. You say in the brain you can see the brain patterns of a psychopath.
Yes.
That the violence encountered by young children, for example, block off trauma and everything becomes post-traumatic for the rest of their lives, that could actually affect the amygdala rather than the amygdala affecting the behavior.
Or you're saying, is it something, or does it transform as a result of those experiences, or are they born that way? Nobody, none of these studies have looked at, you know, obviously they don't study these people when they're young. They study them once they're psychopaths, so we don't know cause and effect. It's an interesting question, though. Okay. So I think.
Your signature for the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Luckily, one of the students got this in time.